He rode as a river builds a delta, by overlay and accretion. His galleys were as black with corrections as Balzac's. The first section, Cambrai, and the last, an afternoon party with music at the house of the Princess d'Egremont, were written first. The rest of the book was middle. To write an interleaf and interline, around the rim as Joyce would do, that was his method. It was our curious good fortune, too, that another war with the Germans interrupted the appearance of the work which Proust himself called, simply, Swan, allowing it in the meantime to more than double. This should not surprise us, for it was the untiming of time itself that was Proust's project. He lifted ticks from the clock and froze them as the furniture and lights are frozen in those Vermeers which he favored with some of his best pages. It was not to rescue time itself that he started out, but to redeem himself, to save all that life which he had let so worthlessly flow by, every moment of it, to reclaim it and then invest it with a verbal value it never had as a human happening. For who knew better than he the genius in him, blooming like the rose which Mallarmé had suggested was absent from every bouquet, the genius who was to display his excellence when? Well, every day it was still tomorrow. Who knew better his baseness, his guilt, the crimes he had contrived? He was, after all, a useless idler, ill half the time and a fake for a fourth of that. He was a jealous whiner and a faithless sycophant, a purchaser of favors and a false friend, a social trifler and a snob. He had a dilettante's interest in music and painting, a brat's love of mama, a fairy's fondness for furbelows, finery, and female life, and a love of gossip that would have left him, had he indulged it fully, without a single back to bite. How did the great call come? It came, of course, in those celebrated moments when the past rushed back open-armed, contrite, forgiving, like a lover who has quarreled and wishes to make amends. When, in the novel, the narrator tastes the Madeleine dipped in tea. When he studies the steeples of Martinville or catches sight of those three trees. When he stumbles on a pair of paving stones or touches a shoe button, feels a napkin on his lips, smells a moldy odor, hears a sound of water in a pipe or a spoon rung by a servant against a plate. Taste, touch, sound, sight, smell. Through each of the senses at one point or other, the past is recaptured, but noticeably without the anxieties and disappointments of the original occasion, so that even the most shameful times, in these remembrances of them, lack that threatening immersion and immediate emotion they first had. Now they can be held like a blossom. They can actually, even the most trivial, the most fearful of them, be transformed, not by the Marcel who experienced them originally, but by another, the Marcel who holds a poet's pen and can contrive a line so beautiful its author can claim a virtue for every vice it limbs. Before and after. Yes, with a little work they can be saved. It's the present, the immediate moment, the during, that is doomed. Before the narrator watches the actress Burma play Phedre, before he sees a little church in Baalbek, both are perfect. Inaccessible, he says of the church, intact, ideal, endowed with universal value. Such is the art of romantic expectations. But Baalbek was a name, he has to confess, that he should have kept hermetically sealed, somewhat like a private letter, or perhaps his writing room. Because the moment it was broken into, there were loosed, to sully the church and its illustrious virgin, the images of a branch bank, omnibus office, pastry shop, café. Experience was in constant danger from these contrasts, the sublime and the sordidly commercial, for example, the kind of undercutting contradiction which delighted Flaubert, who counted the scratches of the wedding plates, and which could never have dismayed more robust men, our Balzacs and our Zolas, they have their strengths. Nor could the rarer objects, refined taste, sharp wit, the right people and their real accomplishments, the precious effects he so dearly loved, always be protected by the bibelots of fashionable parlors, where, as likely as not, the wealthy hostess was a bourgeois whore, or the clever baron an affected pederast, while in the glitter of his company the rest were sniveling sycophants and bores. Nor could he come to terms with himself, for what was one to say of an intermittently fastidious, though aging and increasingly puffy-faced fop who had a yen sometimes at the Homo house he helped to suit out with his family's furniture for strong young men who worked in butcher shops? In short, then, Proust planned to replace his life with language, to restore it to beauty as you might restore a church, and thus to pull it out of time and seal it like a freezer package, protecting it from every vulgarity as the Baalbek church in his book was not. Though he was half a Catholic, it wasn't confession he was after. Confession might suit Gide. Gide had a compulsion in that direction. He thought it allowed him everything. So Gide would complain of Proust's work that it wasn't honest, and that Proust, so close to the edge already, should have cried, "I." That he should have spoken of loving Albert, not, as he wrote, of loving Albertine. Gide had a point, because those disguises did not work. They merely obstructed, obscured, and lamed. But it was not in the recovery of any actual past that Proust's genius lay. His was not a novel of remembrance, as I've pointed out, but a novel of analysis and reflection. Proust returned to his childhood the way a modern primitive returns to the woods, with his books, his bankroll, and a stash of pot. And Remy de Gourmont's saying that one only writes well about things one hasn't experienced remained importantly true, because what Proust intended to write was not so much an account of his life, he would of course condense, amalgamate, rearrange, and select, but something that would give it meaning and worth. Remembrance of things past is, like most great examples of the novelist's art, an act of love, of hate and revenge, and finally, of reparation. Proust lives in it as he failed to live in life, and it would be more appropriate to celebrate the hours in which he began it, were there such moments, than the confused and frightened days of his confinement. But before he could embark upon its composition, Proust had to develop a fictional strategy that would radically single his mind, slow the drain of neurasthenia on his spirit, and, by indulging his deepest nature, find employment for all his vagrant energies, in this way permitting, for example, his morbid suspicion and excessive possessiveness, his inclination to symbolic cruelty and ritual desecration, to have a constructive outlet, and allowing him to exercise exactly the painstaking and painful reappraisal of every occasion which was his constant bedtime occupation. For then his mind was not one wolf, but 20. It could bring down anything. There, his jealous instability was the law of love, and in the scheme he finally settled on, his obsessive concerns, homosexuality, snobbery and the breakup of classes, the pleasures and anxieties of being in society, the religion of art, became recurrent themes in an enormous Mahler-esque composition in which these subjects themselves were entered, overcome, and eventually replaced by the style of their own depiction. Remember that description of Madame Swann's gowns, which is more laced and bowed and ruffled, more exquisitely daring, more utterly elaborated than they are, and beneath which she sinks from sight as a thread of grass does in a bouquet of daisies. Proust was always ready to have his friends defend the organization of remembrance of things past, and there can be no doubt his tapestry is intricate and cunningly worked. Yet much of the so-called form in Proust is meaningless, an excuse. Like the elaborate Homeric correspondence in Ulysses, it's meant only for the mind. It placates critics who chase relations like lawyers trying to settle rich estates. An unfeelable form is a failure. Furthermore, it's hard to imagine what the architecture of this novel would have excluded, since forms, like fences, are meant to keep the cows out as well as the corn in. No, it is largely a wonderful wallow. It can accommodate anything, including little essays on love, art, literature, and life. Nor should we too readily accept the idea that the fuses of these involuntary memories, the Madeleine, the shoe button, the paving stone, etc., really set off the rest of the text. Otherwise, we should have to believe that, when those little powdered strings are lit, a miracle of physics occurs, one in which the boom blows up the bomb. Proust despised the aesthete with all the hate Hogg has for Hogg, and believed that the novel would uncover, in a way no other method could manage, the essential truth of his life. But he was a liar like all the others, a master of dissimulation and subterfuge. There is no special truth in him. He would capture our consciousness if he could and give us a case of his nerves. Still, no danger. When the fuss over Proust's theories about memory and time has faded, when we have taken what we can for psychology from his own reflections on his characters, when we have faithfully observed, as Proust did, the intrusion, like a second row of teeth, of the middle into the upper classes, when we have ceased to be shocked by inversion or amused by period dress and manners, and it's been well past when now for many years, then it is only Proust's style that will carry this enormous book, the style of his mind, his sight and hearing, touch and feeling, and above all, the unique character of his language and its extraordinary composition, a style where image and object, like Jack and Jill, go up and down together.